The Holy Gospel according to Matthew, the 9th chapter. Glory to you, O Lord. As Jesus was walking along, he saw a man called Matthew sitting at the tax collector station and said to him, "Follow me." And Matthew got up and followed him. As Jesus reclined at dinner in the house, many tax collectors and sinners came and were sitting with Jesus and his disciples. When the Pharisees saw this, they said to his disciples, "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" But when Jesus heard this, he said, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick, go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice, for I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners." While he was still saying these things to them, suddenly a leader came in and knelt before him, saying, "My daughter has just died, but come and lay your hand on her, and she will live." And Jesus got up and followed him with his disciples. Then suddenly a woman who had been suffering from a flow of blood for 12 years came up behind him and touched the fringe of his cloak. For she was saying to herself, "If I only touch his cloak, I will be made well." Jesus turned and seeing her said, "Take heart, daughter. Your faith has made you well." And the woman was made well from that moment. When Jesus came to the leader's house and saw the flute players and the crowd making a commotion, he said, "Go away, for the girl is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. But when the crowd had been put outside, he went in and took her by the hand, and the girl got up. And the report of this spread through all of that district. The Gospel of the Lord. Praise you, O Christ. Please be seated. Grace, mercy, and peace be to you in the name of Jesus. Amen. By whose authority? That is the question that I think binds these three stories together. By what authority does Jesus do what he is doing? Last week, we went backwards a little bit into the Sermon on the Mount to connect a few dots about how Jesus is laying the framework for the entirety of his ministry in that teaching segment. Right after that, in chapter 8 and chapter 9, we have a series of stories that very much matches Mark and Luke in how Jesus' ministry unfolds. He calls disciples, he eats at a table with disciples and sinners, he heals the sick, he heals a leper, he raises a paralytic, and all the while it is ruffling the feathers of the Pharisees and the scribes. And so these quick stories in succession demonstrate that. One, for Jesus to call someone like a tax collector would have ruffled everybody's feathers at his time, not just his disciples. Tax collectors play a particular role in that society and in that time and place, and they are not liked by anyone. They are the middlemen between Rome, the rulers of the territory, and the people. They don't abide by their own religious law, and they skirt Roman law as best they can. Basically, the accusation against them is that you take too much. You skim some off the top. You're dishonest. You're greedy. And so for Jesus to invite one such as this to follow him would have not sat well with anybody. So immediately, there is question of why. Why does Jesus do this? To add insult to injury for those watching, Jesus then goes to this individual's house and has the audacity to break bread, share a meal. Recline at the table is what the Greek says, and this is a very stylized meal. It's not like where we would gather together, much like after worship, with hot dogs and ice cream. This is about demonstrating power and prestige and rank within the community. Even though a tax collector is dishonest and greedy, because of their economic resources, they are often seen higher up in the community. by some. So Jesus breaks bread, reclines, and it's all very visible. Everybody knows what's going on. So the Pharisees show up and they try to slyly ask his disciples, what is going on? Why is Jesus, who spoke all of these elaborate words, who has been healing, who has been causing quite a stir, push it further and dine with tax collectors and sinners? It is a challenge of authority. Jesus' reputation has set that forth, that he is one in authority, one who can teach authoritatively, one who reaches back into the lineage of the ancestors of faith, interprets and instructs. If he's following the laws of our ancestors, then he knows that something is wrong with this picture. That's what I imagine the Pharisees conjuring up as they walk into the house. But Jesus overhears this and says, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. Now, that phrase doesn't end well in English. I don't think we know quite how to punctuate it. Is it a question mark? Is it one of those places in language where we can imagine Jesus looking and giving a bit of side eye to the Pharisees? Like, but those who are sick. I'm not looking at anybody particularly. Begs the question, who are the sick ones here? Is it the Pharisees? Is it Jesus? Is it the tax collectors and the sinners? It all hinges on this question of authority. And to prove that point, Jesus quotes from our first reading, Hosea, I desire mercy, not sacrifice. Jesus almost confirms that the ones who are in need of a physician in this case are the Pharisees, because he prescribes them something to do that might help in their own healing. Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. Now, he could not have picked a more loaded phrase from that particular piece of Hosea. We get a small fraction of Hosea 6 in our first reading, and it's the more palatable piece, I dare say. To understand Hosea, we have to understand a bit of the history of the people. So a quick step back into that time. Hosea is one of those prophets that is working and writing in the in-between. We're pretty sure he was working in the northern kingdom of Israel, the 10 tribes of that northern aspect of the entirety of God's people, Judah being the southern part. And he's working amongst the northern kingdom of Israel at about the time the Assyrians are rising in power, and then they come in and wipe out northern Israel in 722. It's thought after that his prophetic work continues as it moves south into Judea and Jerusalem, and his words of critique to the leaders of Israel get repurposed for the leaders of Judah, basically pointing to the same thing. You have transgressed the covenant. This is the gravest accusation that a prophet can make against the king or the people, that they have gone back on the covenant that God made with them. There's a whole series of literature in the Torah and the prophets about what the cost of transgressing covenant is. And one of those is to be ensnared and taken over by another nation. The prophets later on in Israel's history did a magnificent, tricky, and brilliant thing of shifting the idea that once they had been defeated, their God was no longer powerful, which is how every other nation state in the ancient world worked. Instead, they said, no, our God is using this as punishment. So instead of being wiped out and assimilating into whatever power had conquered them, the Israelites, covenantal Israel, began to understand that as punishment for transgressing covenants. And in the midst of this, we have Hosea speaking those words, for I desire steadfast love, not sacrifice, the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. This is an echo not just in Hosea, It is one that is echoed by every prophet writing at the time of the Jewish folks coming back from exile in Babylon. Back when they come to their land where the temple has been destroyed and all of their practices are disrupted, where they come back and folks are still living in the land trying to figure it out, and they come back and try to play by all the rules. They try to establish authority. And those who don't follow authority are politely and sometimes not so politely asked to either get with the program or leave. So the prophetic reminder then, I desire steadfast love or mercy, not sacrifice. Basically shorthand for saying all of the sacrifices, all the things you do in the temple, all the ways you think I am looking for that will demonstrate how pious and religious you are, miss the concept completely. The covenant was never solely about sacrifice and making sure to get it exactly right. The heart of covenant, the one that I am now writing on your hearts, as Jeremiah has God saying, is about taking care of one another. It's about love of neighbor, love of stranger. It's about making this project called humanity work. So when Jesus quotes Hosea, he's not just picking up a random phrase. He's using that as an allusion to the entirety of the critique of the prophets. Yes, we had the Torah and the law. But when that gets used as a measure of exclusion, when it gets used as a series of boxes to check, when it gets used as a manual to get things exactly right, we've missed the point. The Pharisees had local authority at this time. They were the ones that dealt in the religious and communal power. They were the ones that often held banquets like Matthew the tax collector to demonstrate how good they were, how influential they were. They were the ones that carried the lineage, not the people in Jerusalem. These were local authorities on a communal level. Jesus existing is a challenge to their authority. Jesus interpreting the scriptures is a challenge to their authority. And here's the thing about what Jesus quotes, I desire mercy, not sacrifice, is that mercy in and of itself has everything to do with authority. Mercy is rather one of those words like love. We throw it out there, but context and history matter. Mercy is extended by an authority toward a subject who has failed to meet expectations. I'm going to say that again. Mercy is extended by an authority toward a subject who has failed to meet expectations. It's a power dynamic. Mercy can only be issued from someone in a place of power to one who has fallen short. It's a way of reaching outside of where there are gaps in the law to keep community going. When a subject fails to abide by the law, whatever that means, the authority may select and resort to mercy when failure is due to some kind of inability by the person. The act of mercy has the same results as the objective of the law, namely to establish and confirm the authority. So the law was a working document. It had gaps. It was never perfect. It has never been perfected. And so in moments where there seems to be no way the law can govern the in-betweens, and someone would be cut off from community as a result of their actions, mercy is used as a bit of glue to fill the gap. Does that make sense? Playing with a new definition of mercy here. So it's a glue in the gap between law and no existing law to keep authority established. So the question then begs, why is Jesus now challenging those who assume authority in the community to take a second look at it? Here's my hunch. The Pharisees, for all of the positive things they were doing in community, were not good at extending mercy. In some instances, they're called legalists, following the letter of the law, and this is actually what gets Jesus into so much trouble. both in his time and 50 years later when Matthew was writing to another community, trying to live as Jesus taught, which is having its own struggle with authority after the collapse and destruction of the temple. Who are we going to follow? By whose authority? Well, the Pharisees don't seem like they were very good at mercy, filling in the gaps. And here's why I think that. Every time Jesus gets challenged, it's because he heals in a way that the law doesn't seem to fully inform. Take the very next story, a woman bleeding for 12 years. There is no metric in Torah for that. Blood is unclean, yes. There are metrics for healing that. If you're a woman, it looks a little bit different. If you're a man, it looks a little bit different. If you're a soldier, it looks a little bit different. If you're a priest, it looks a little bit different. But there are metrics to heal once the blood has stopped flowing. It's cleanliness. It's actually not a whole big deal like we've made it out to be. Wait until the sun goes down, perform the ritual, you're clean, done. There's no contingency for somebody who's bleeding for 12 years. The law doesn't know what to do with that. The teachers of the law don't know what to do with that. And so this person, this woman, this unnamed individual who becomes a daughter by faithfulness gets left in this gap for 12 years. Because there's no authority to welcome her back into community. There's nobody that can figure out how to stop it. There's no metric to figure out how to make sure she's clean. And so she lives in a nebulous world of unclean, impure, dirty, marginalized, forgotten. Probably 1,000 words that we could come up with to describe an individual in that state. And what irritates the Pharisees and what irritates people who like good order so much is that Jesus dares healing her. And oh, by the way, she touched him first. Multiple levels in this story challenge authority. The Pharisees go from questioning Jesus' authority to Jesus telling them, reframe how you understand what you're doing, to a man bursting in saying, my daughter has died. If you come and lay your hand on her, again, another transgression. Don't touch dead people. So no. She will live. So Jesus gets up and goes with his disciples. In the middle of that, the woman reaches out of the crowd, touching Jesus, which would have made him unclean. So he'd have to shut down for the day and wait until sun to go down, cleanse himself and go on about his business. In all of this, Jesus breaks the framework that world had been operating in. He's shattering the authority of the local rulers. Now, I'm not going to throw them completely under the bus, because after all, they're living under occupation. The Romans have taken over, and there is no light at the end of the tunnel, and they're doing the best they can in their circumstances. They've got about this much power, or they think they do, to operate in religious freedom, again, about that much power. And under that pressure, I think that they are doing the best to keep the wheels on the car. We can be very judgmental looking back and say, oh, they're operating in bad faith. It's always complicated. But Jesus pushes it, as he does on the Sermon of the Mount. You have heard that it was said, but I say unto you, I desire mercy, not sacrifice. This is what it's going to look like. Woman bleeding for 12 years, we're going to heal her. Her faithfulness makes her well. Girl who has died, Jesus walks into the house, and they've got a room full of people, flute players, and a crowd making commotion, literally paid mourners. Folks paid to come in and sing the sad songs and the dirges. And when Jesus says the girl is not dead but sleeping, they laugh at him because it's a ludicrous statement. And yet he goes into the back room, takes her by the hand, and literally resurrects her. Because that's the word that Matthew uses, egero, to raise up. That's the word of resurrection. When you want to challenge authority and ruffle feathers, you start raising people to new life. But that's not the only resurrection in this story. You see, Matthew was also resurrected from a cycle of death where he is ensnared by greed and driving his own people further into debt, further marginalizing them. Matthew being called by Jesus is a resurrection story. Jesus reaching across the table and prescribing the Pharisees something to study so that they can get better is an attempt at resurrection. Jesus raising the daughter who'd been bleeding for 12 years to new life is an act of resurrection. Jesus raising the young girl is an act of resurrection. And this is the authority by which we are called. When we live out authority based on who God is and what God does, it will ruffle feathers. When we do acts of resurrection in this world, like working among folks in poverty, challenging systems that keep people in poverty, when we do anti-racist work, when we support our LGBTQ siblings, it ruffles feathers of those in authority. Because when we start drawing outside that box, anything can happen. And that terrifies some people. By whose authority? God's. That is always, always our call, always our point of reference. And so for us, I think it's a very practical use to be reminded, I desire mercy, not sacrifice. We can dress up anything in religious ritual and call it good, but it doesn't mean it's addressing a benevolent, loving God. But learning what mercy looks like, the mercy God first extended to us to fill all of the gaps that we could create, a mercy extended to us to say, no, death does not have the last word, a mercy extended to us so that we can use it graciously as ones with the authority to do so. That's a gift of baptism. Our authority to gracefully use this authority. So I desire mercy, not sacrifice. I want you to hold on to that phrase. I want you to put it in your back pocket, and I want you to keep bringing it back to these stories. Because I haven't taken a look at all of the stories we're going to take in this summer as our gospel readings, but I hazard a guess that most of them have to do with this metric. Jesus healing, doing whatever Jesus does, challenges authority, and Jesus constantly trying to bring people along into what God's love is all about. Please hold on to that one. Bring it back next week. Amen.